Ready? All right. We'll call the community development meeting to order. Item two, public comment. I see Ryan Tillman is here. He's got a few questions for us. So Ryan, you want to come up to the table? Welcome.
Thank you. Some of you might not know that the city of Wilmer has a ordinance, chapter 6.5, article 2, division 2, about bed bugs, is saying that the owner of the apartment complex is responsible for the bed bugs. I would like that changed, revised somehow. It's not the owner of the building's fault that they're there. It's the tenants that are bringing them there. We do annual sweeps of our building 3 times a year with Plunkett's, a certified company that comes through and checks them all. And we want to bill our tenants back for it. But with this city ordinance in effect, we can't do that.
And the apartments you manage are?
I manage the Hanson Apartments and the Maplewood Apartments. It used to be the old Willow Run 2 buildings.
Okay. So that's a lot of apartments.
Yeah, I oversee about 150 apartments. And with that in there, I can't turn around and now bill my tenants back because of this ordinance saying that.
Does it say you can't?
Yeah, so the owner is responsible for it.
You're responsible for removing the infestation. What you do internally, I believe, would be up to you.
But what they're saying, or the attorneys are saying, is that because that says that in there, it's coming back on the owner. Infestation, I mean, if you have one or two apartments, you're going to have 15. I mean, that's the thing.
Yeah.
And we go through annually and we check all of our apartments. I don't know if there's something that we can change in the wording saying that, you know, if it's done in an annual inspection and you have the paperwork to go with it, I don't know. But last year it cost our apartment complex almost $32,000.
So some of your tenants have had bed bugs?
Correct.
And they've gone to attorneys?
Yes, we went back to charge them and they went to the attorneys and I've got all the paperwork and they say that we can't charge them back for the units because of the city ordinance.
And then you said something was changed January of 15?
It says December 1, 4, 2015. City ordinance mandated it said.
December?
That's what it's saying.
Of 15. You remember doing that?
3 months ago? Absolutely not. I don't recall anything like that going through council. We haven't dealt with any of these rental ordinance issues for a long time.
Yeah. So what were you looking at there? Is that
this is what the attorneys gave back to us was the city ordinance that the city of Wilmer had.
Does it say Wilmer on there?
Yep, it says the Wilmer City Code and Ordinance mandated December 1-4-15. Extermination infestation is responsible of the owner as the infestation consists of two or more dwellings in the units.
December 1-4-15. I don't even know what that would mean.
Can you make a copy of that?
You can have this. I've got this on my...
Okay. Well, we'll check it out and let the city attorney look at it.
Yeah.
I don't doubt that that's... wait a minute. Failure to comply with HUD handbook, chapter 6.
That also falls in...
Must be under the municipal code.
So where's the best place to get a hold of you, at one of the apartments or
at
home?
I can give you a telephone number.
Okay.
320.
Okay.
269.
269.
1-889.
1-889. That's Monty, isn't it?
Yes. My phone is out of Montevideo. That's the home office.
All right. We'll check that one out. Larry?
What's your thoughts on billing back? Are you thinking, like, if you have a 12-plex, you would divide the bill by 12 and assess each?
No, each unit is heat-treated, and a unit for a one-bedroom is about $1,000 to $1,100. A two-bedroom is $1,200 to $1,300, and so on and so forth. We can put them in one room. We can treat the whole unit. They put a powder on the outside, so if they crawl through it, they die. So the person that brought it in should be responsible for it because we've gone through and treated everything beforehand. So we've gone through all the buildings and we've paid it all, cleaned off the whole building, and then go back 3 months later and there's more. There's new infestations in the units.
So how much an apartment does it cost to treat a
A one-bedroom apartment is about $1,100. A two-bedroom is about $1,300. A three-bedroom is about $1,400 to $1,500.
So and that's for roaches or bed bugs?
That's for bed bugs.
I didn't think they had chemicals that would kill them.
It's a chemical they put around the outside that when they go through it, it's a powder that they go through it and they'll kill them.
Okay.
So you're thinking,
I don't know how they get them to go through it.
Just not supposed to natural run around it.
They could very well be. But it's usually, they usually stay right where the source is usually the bed.
And they heat up the apartment.
They heat the apartment up to about 130 degrees for about 4 to 5 hours.
And then they try to...
And then they try to, of course, escape from the heat so they don't die.
Okay. That's where they go on.
Yes.
Okay.
But I mean, like, if the fall Texas was totally infested, then everybody would get a...
Everybody would have to get a bill for it. Yeah. Yes.
Bill from the exterminator?
The apartment complex, we pay it, and then we charge it back to the tenant on a monthly payment process, because most tenants aren't going to have $1,500 just laying around. So we do a payment process with them. And we have this thing, but there's nobody to enforce. There's other apartment complexes that are completely full, like downtown, that are full of bed bugs, and the owners don't have the money to fix it. So, you know.
Well, if it's encountered in the rental program, it's cited. We don't care if they've got the money or not. If it's a violation that's noted, they get a citation. So
they should contact the city. The Plunkett's guy should contact the city saying they were called over here and the owner doesn't have the money to fix it?
I would say it's not up to Plunkett's to contact us because we're not going to pay it.
No, but I'm just saying, who's going to cite who?
When the rental inspections are done, when they conduct rental inspections,
yep,
or when we get a tenant complaint,
yep,
we'll go out, and if we determine there's an infestation,
mm-hmm,
the owner gets written up.
Okay.
So then we've got a record to track it. And at that point, we don't say, if you've got the money, take care of,
yep,
this matter. They're just told to fix it. So.
But most of them don't have the money. That's where, and then they move out down there to my apartments now, and now I get stuck paying that infestation bill that the other apartment complex didn't have.
I know. I had another landlord say that the city, that there's some people out there doing treatment that aren't necessarily, may not be reputable. Is that also an issue?
I always use a reputable company. There could very well be. There's other companies that come around that offer it. Some of them offer a chemical treatment that doesn't work, but they attempt.
And that's what someone said, is that maybe the city ought to be licensing these bed bug companies so that they do have a reputable product.
How often do we inspect apartments again in apartment buildings? 2 years and 3 years?
It depends upon how many units are in each building. It could be anywhere from 1 year to 3 years.
So the buildings downtown would have 4 or 5 apartments?
They should be done in about every other year, yeah.
Every other,
yeah.
Okay. We'll check with city attorney.
All right, that's fine.
That in, and then your other issue was the meter?
The meters.
For the water and sewer.
Correct.
Okay.
This looks like it's something an attorney prepared with citations and that, doesn't it, Tim?
Hmm.
Did I leave you guys that down there?
Is that the only thing?
The meter bill or not?
We got one page here.
All right. The other thing I like to bring up is the utility bill out of our apartment complex. Our service meter charge is $1,176 a month to read our meters. I'm thinking that should, if that is the electrical meters, that should go back to the tenants, and the owner should be responsible for paying that. And that's a hefty charge. We paid $28,000 last year in meter reader charges on two of the six buildings that we have.
So that was electric, it's not the water.
It says...
It's not gas either, right?
Meter charge, total water charge. I can leave that here with you too, I got another copy of that.
Okay. And then we discussed earlier, Sean's on the...
Yes.
Are you on the commission too?
Well, I was, but maybe you've had some discussions with Wes or maybe others regarding this, but to the best of my understanding was... That's not really what the charge is for, the meter reading charge. I, I don't know how better to explain what it is for.
Okay.
But
it's based on the size of the pipe, the size of the meter,
right,
and the flow.
And it's yeah. not actually a service charge, so to speak, like to, you know, some. I've had calls with people saying, why am I being charged to determine how much to charge me? And I've put it that way to Mr. Hunt, and he responded by telling me that's not what it is. So, and my comment then was, okay, maybe we better take a look at how better to label what these charges are in terms of describing it, because I believe the description there is a little bit elusive, because there's other people that are complaining about the same thing, saying, how can we be charged as we're being determined how much to charge?
Yep, I asked him that last fall too, because on there it shows that they're charging you for charging you.
Yes, exactly.
And I said, well, that doesn't make sense. You go to a grocery store, and are they going to charge us for ringing us up?
Right.
I mean, but he said they got new software, and it's really broken down, and I think it's broken down too far on how it's labeled, but...
I will take that one forward, and I'll get you a response. And
okay.
You
want Ryan
to... They told us that we have to pay $30 per unit. That's what they're telling us, and we call and ask. So $30 per unit, then why aren't we charging the tenant? Or is that electricity, or is that water? What, you know, and why are we paying for one meter? It doesn't cost $1,100 to one meter in each building.
Larry?
It's kind of a demand charge. Like if you have a 3/4 inch line, there's a base rate for that.
Mm-hmm.
And then like if you have all your units on one meter,
yeah.
And so you might have, say, a 2 or 3 inch meter,
mm-hmm.
and then that's a demand charge. And that's kind of your baseline of what you get charged for minimum service. And then there's a usage charge on top of that.
So does anything restrict him from charging that back to his tenants?
I get my question would be, why wouldn't you build it back into the rates?
Well, when the owner bought this, he had no idea. So when he took over these foreclosed buildings, and then this bill came on, he was like, what is this?
Occasionally you'll have multifamily units that have individual meters, and then other times they put one big one in.
So, yeah.
But I think that we can give this to Sean.
Yeah, that's fine.
And yeah. Your phone number?
320-269. 1885.
So when does the utilities meet in? Monday?
Or
they're done now for March?
It'll be in 2 weeks on Monday.
In April.
In April, yep.
And they meet at noon.
We meet at noon at the utility. 11:45 at the utilities building. But I will make sure that this is on their radar screen.
Yeah, I mean, HRA, I sit on the HRA board too, so that's their question too. That's what they're explaining too, that it was per unit. They're being charged for. That's...
There's a wastewater charge, as I understand it, right? Like $20 per unit.
Without looking at the bill, I couldn't.
There is a wastewater charge that he has on here as well, but I don't know how many units you have on here. But
there'd be 42 on that unit.
Because it's about $1,200 for the, would you say 42 units?
42 mm-hmm. units, yes.
30 bucks.
Right.
And that's to pay for the
sewer
plant.
Yeah, but you know, if we, you know, some of those charges can be pushed back to the tenant on their utility bill. You know, that's what their electrical bill or whatever.
But if you say you're paying for the water and the sewer, and they pay the electric,
yeah, they pay the electric.
I don't know how the utilities could build it into their electric bill if it's not an electric charge. I think it would be far simpler for the owner to build it into the rent.
Okay. Yeah, if that's the case, that's...
I don't know that there's anything that would prohibit that. I mean, that's...
Shouldn't.
All right. We're just looking for answers.
I'd say if I can't give you a good answer, then maybe that's the solution, is that if that's something you can do.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. That's all I got.
All right.
But if you want to attend that meeting, you can.
You want to give me a call then and let me know?
Yep, sure.
I don't... When is it?
It'll be
April 4th.
Yep, it'll be April 4th.
11:45.
At
the utilities?
Yep.
All right.
sure. I'd recommend just, you know, go over that during business hours.
We've, both HRA and the offices contacted, and they said it was a $30 apartment, per apartment rent is what they're,
okay,
is what they're saying, so.
Well, thanks for coming, Ryan.
Thank you.
All right.
What was that number, John?
Oh, his phone number?
Yeah.
269-1885. You get Ryan Tillman?
Yeah.
Ryan Tillman. All right, next item is, what is this called? Oh, there we go. Ordinance for imposing residency restrictions on sexual offenders.
Yep.
And predators.
You've all been provided with a copy of the ordinance with the agenda. Little background, committee's been hearing about this for a while, has had several discussions up as far as the full city council. Discussions really initiated in response to citizen concerns over safety and neighborhood property values. City attorney had previously advised the council as to its authority and limitations. The city cannot impose an outright ban on housing sex offenders, but it can reasonably restrict the location and concentration of such housing. For the purposes of this ordinance that the city attorney prepared, he provided a 500-foot radius as the standard that the city should enforce should they choose to adopt such an ordinance, and that would be 500 feet, within 500 feet of a school, licensed daycare center, park, public playground, or place of worship. Initial part of the regulatory process will be to map areas where offenders may not live. I have that right here. We have a scale drawing showing where those 500-foot circles would be, or 500-foot limits. Obviously, the map's going to have to be updated with some frequency, and we're going to have to maintain pretty regular contact with the Office of the Minnesota Commissioner of Corrections, as well as Canty High County Public Services, or Human Services. Looking at the ordinance, the cost of enforcing it would be primarily for staff time. There are no funds budgeted for such enforcement, and it's really difficult to estimate the budgetary impact of enforcement. Initially, it would be rather low because, as Chief Felt has informed me, there are very few registered sex offenders of any level, 1, 2, or 3, that currently reside in the city. And got a little additional communication from City Attorney Scott this afternoon, and he says that the email that you got earlier with the links to the studies and resources was simply for background information. It says studies do not conclusively show that residency restrictions are necessary to protect public safety or whether or not they are effective at doing so. But at least the studies conducted by the Department of Corrections can't be said to have been conducted by a disinterested party, as DOC has opposed local residency restrictions. The legislature has concluded that such restrictions do in some cases serve an important governmental interest. And then he gives a statutory citation for that. And basically it's regulating the concentration of level 3 offenders. And we've taken it a step further to include level 1 and 2. Mr. Scott says that the ordinance he prepared is less restrictive than the sample ordinances simply because the radius surrounding protected gathering places that he's prepared was 500 feet, and in a lot of those other ordinances they did 1,000 or 2,000 foot radiuses. If you went more than 500 feet, you would make the city of Wilmer virtually uninhabitable for sex offenders, and that would be a constitutional issue at that point. Robert says that court decisions from other jurisdictions where local residency restriction regulations were invalidated typically cited the regulation's extensive reach in denying offenders any opportunity to find housing. So you've got to make it available, but you can protect certain gathering locations. Robert concludes by saying that the decision to adopt the ordinance or make changes to it is strictly a policy decision for the city. I'm not making a recommendation in favor or against adoption of the ordinance. I'm but rather he has researched the issues of regulating sexual offenders and prepared the ordinance to accomplish the committee's objectives and to be as legally defensible as possible. In the council action request that staff prepared, it included a recommendation that the ordinance be introduced for a public hearing and to ultimately adopt the ordinance. The more I've actually thought about it and considered it internally, I don't see it as a significant issue. And from a staff standpoint, I would change my recommendation and say that no action be taken at this time to move forward with adopting an ordinance. There's a lot of conjecture, a lot of speculation you can do about location of sexual offenders and sexual predators, but the issues have not borne themselves out in the community. If you wish to be strictly proactive and to do it, we've prepared maps that show what sites would be available. If you look at this map shows all the properties that would be protected, surrounded by a 500-foot buffer. Pretty well eats up the city of Wilmer. It leaves very, very few locations where a resident could live. And this is, again, churches, schools, parks, playgrounds, and 62 licensed daycare facilities.
That would be the areas in blue?
That are prohibited, yes.
Yeah. Yep.
And contrast that. Here's a 250-foot buffer area.
And we were also going to do 1,000 feet.
If you did 1,000, just the entire city would be blue. So
be so much overlap.
Yeah. Well, I mean, so they didn't do a 1,000-foot map?
Not at this scale. I've got a 1,000-foot map, I believe, at a smaller scale. Here's your 1,000. No, that's 750. I'm sorry. We didn't get a 1,000-foot one done. You can see every time you... Yeah, it's just the mall.
But Mr. Scott's opinion was that anything in excess of this left such little area that would not or could not potentially be considered reasonable and could possibly be challenged in court.
Right. It really would really make the ordinance indefensible based on prior action that the courts have taken.
You were reading from something from him. When was that received?
I got it.
Let's see. Today,
3:21 today. So, and it was sent to myself, city administrator, and Chris Hood with his firm. So, the reason he put that in writing was because he thought it might answer some questions. He is available for a phone call right now. He said he was going to be in his office, so if there are questions that the committee have that for the city attorney, we can certainly call him up on a conference call.
I attended a meeting at a business in Wilmer some time ago. Mr. Ingman was present. The mayor was there, and my understanding was the maps that I'd talked to the mayor about doing, that there'd be a 1,000-foot one, and that they'd be copies and I asked them, look for them, haven't found them, and when I've been in here, nobody's been around to ask where they are.
Well, the mayor's never conveyed that, so apparently the mayor did not get his maps made.
My understanding was it had been made already when we met. Is that your understanding, Mr. Engen, or you recall? Or?
Marv had Curly draw some maps, and then Marv was sharing them with the different people at the meeting.
Okay, that may be something that hasn't come through my office. Might have gone directly from engineering to the mayor then.
I think he had done that a month ago, because I remember seeing circles of different 500,000
$2,000. And like I say, I'd asked for copies. I never got them. I was gone to Florida, but I did look for them when I came back. And
Larry?
I was just going to say, the 500 shows that it almost covers the entire city. Yeah. 1,000 is obviously going to make this whole thing blue.
Well, I don't know if that, obviously, if it would or not, Larry. I can't tell. I like to see it. Most cities have gone with 1,000 or more. I understand what some of the legal constraints are here, or maybe, because I did do some legal research on this following the meeting with Mr. Engen and the mayor and some other people. And, the case law goes both ways. It's state courts, there's disagreement there. There's also disagreement in the federal courts. So there's no consistent position on it, but I also believe that the city has authority to do this, as does Mr. Scott. It comes under our general police powers. We're not totally shut out by state legislature's done. So I don't think we've been, there's been any what I would call preemption. And I guess another question I had is, why do we need to be contacting the Commissioner of Corrections, Bruce? You mentioned that, and I was wondering where that comes from.
Well, we would want to make sure that we know who's being discharged, and they do that with the police with the level threes.
Okay.
Twos and ones, we may not have, it's just going to take some communication just so we know
you're
that
talking
these people
about follow-up with, what we can expect might be coming to our community.
Oh, absolutely, for the purpose of enforcement, Tim.
Okay.
Yeah,
future enforcement. Sure. That's what I wanted to clarify, it was is this okay what we did, and I'm thinking,
we don't have to go to anybody.
Well, that's a question.
Yeah, power clearly lies with the city council.
There were two ways I could understand that, and the way you did it is I thought what you were doing, that they would notify us, so that makes a difference, but...
Chief Felt, do you have an opinion?
Up to this point, the Department of Corrections simply notifies us that an offender is moving to our community and gives us the information for the notifications. The way I view it as right now, whether there was an ordinance in place or not, our procedure would not change, or there wouldn't be any anything extra for the police department. It would be something that the Department of Corrections would have to work around when that offender is released there. So
they tell you now, level three. How about level one and two?
Level twos and level threes they notify us on. For level two offenders, they're rated as a higher likelihood to reoffend, and for that we have to notify the schools and daycare centers in the area where the offender is going to be living. But it's not a full public notification. For a level three offender, the highest likelihood of reoffending, then it's a full public notification.
If we go with an ordinance like this, we'll probably notify the entire community on a level two, wouldn't we?
With that, believe we would. They're protected on the information that we can release there, so we would not be able to release it.
There are some restrictions on certain entities are notified, but it's not
for the
general public.
Correct.
No.
Right.
In other words, and if anybody called up and asked you, they aren't. Unless they're one of the proper entities, they don't get any information.
Correct. That's a good way to
So, Chief, would I understand that when there's a level two or three released and you're notified, at that point, would your department share with the entity that's providing you the notification that we have an ordinance in place and there are residency restrictions for these people? Or are you told where they're going to be?
We are told where they're going to be.
So at that point, then it's up to the PD to look at it and say, no, that's not acceptable?
Usually what's happened is the department, as I understand it, the Department of Corrections has already worked on finding placement for that person or housing for that individual and has determined it's a proper place for them to be ahead of time. So they've already vetted that it's not next to a school, not next to a daycare center, or if there was an ordinance in place like this, they would probably have to be notified that such an ordinance exists.
Okay, that's what I was thinking. We just have to provide notification to DOC that it's in place. And ideally give them a digital map that they can have in their records. And
so how would this affect us now then, if we put this in place like tomorrow? We can't, but would anyone be affected?
From a distance here, just looking at the maps we have, three level three offenders that live in Wilmer right now. One is in the jail, one is in the downtown area, and one lives on Southwest 2nd Street. Just from a distance here, it looks like that
they'd all be blue.
They would be living in the blue areas. However, because if the ordinance, not being an attorney, but because they're already living there and an ordinance is passed, I don't know if it would cause them to be forced to move. You know, that could be a case for any new offenders that are released.
I know at least one of them, I believe, Chief, lives with family members, and I believe that's an exception that the ordinance doesn't reach.
Yes, that's correct.
Right.
Yes.
So that person would be all right. I mean,
can I say something? You know, we've got 34 park system in the city of Wilmer, and we're looking at, I recall, 106,000 in the Rice Park. And now we have a level three sex offender living one block away. And I don't know how you sit there and tie all your parks together and you put a disclaimer on the bottom from the Chamber of Commerce saying, oh, by the way, in this particular one, we've got a level three sex offender that's had minor incidents with minor children, stalking, and vulnerable adults. And that's why I think there is some urgency to try to get something passed on this, because we're still looking at 720 people from St. Peter and Moose Lake that are going to be released someplace. And if the standard is 1,000 feet, I think you should stay with 1,000 feet. Because if you go to 500, and if you read all the studies, they sit there and say, where does your high concentration sex offenders go? Where is it the least problem? And if you are the bottom line, if you look at all these other cities, and I found, to find one at 500 feet, and you want to go 500 feet, you're opening the door to say, you got the resource facilities, you got the less restrictions on it, and this is the place where we're going to sit there and do high density. Because all your studies sit there and say, high density goes where there's the least resistance. And Wilmer is going to be the high density, least resistance go-to place. And you may not sit there and realize that now, but if they sit there and the federal judge has his way and opens up the door for 720 people, you are going to be the go-to place. And that's my main concern, because I have a place that butts up to my property that has a level sex offender, and they put in five bedrooms. And I'm going, okay, I don't have a problem with that. Level three sex offenders, I can live with that. But you know what? They put in five level two or level one, I don't know about it. And you want to come over to my house for the 4th of July picnic with five level two sex offenders in my backyard. You know, bring your wife, your family, your kids, your grandkids. So I'm looking at this thing as a high density sex offenders in the rural area, and I think that there's an obligation by the city council to protect the taxpayers and the quality of life. My quality of life is I think a higher priority than somebody that has violated somebody, that has caused long-term damage to these people. And we had a case here in Wilmer of having 5 to 8 kids back in the 80s and 90s of predatory sex acts, and they're still paying for it today. So if these people get out and are registered and they have a hard time looking a place to live, I don't feel really bad about it, because you know what, we've got guys in their 30s and their 40s that are still had their childhood robbed from them. You know, so the priority should be, are you going to protect the citizens of Wilmer? Same thing with property values, is that, you know, you want to sit there and ding around with 500 foot, and how many people are going to come in and ask for tax reductions? You go to 1,000 feet, and you're not going to have that many. If somebody's going to take you to court, you have all these other cities that also have 1,000, you know, and they're a lot smaller than Wilmer. And if it's going to be an action, let's make it a class action. Let's not make Wilmer a dumping ground. Let's make this a class action lawsuit if you have to do this. But I think there's an obligation. You know, your parks and your schools, you took away all the city schools, so the property values of having the advantage of having parks and schools in your neighborhood is gone. So right now, is that if you're going to a playground, is that you either have to give them a ride there. And if you're 500 feet, where I live, will 500 feet take me halfway between my house and Miller, a zone between Miller, the zone between there and Miller that is unprotected? You're going, why can't I sit there and live four blocks away from Miller Park and have my kids sit there and my grandkids ride their bike over there and not worry about somebody? But I think there is some urgency, because if you don't get out ahead of this, the state of Minnesota, this is going to be a state problem.
They just can't live by the park.
And it's not just going to be a Wilmer problem, because every other city, and it's going to be like Crime Watch. You may not be able to remedy it, but you can displace it. And if you don't want people moving out of Wilmer, I mean, right now I could do a $7,000 deck in my backyard, and I'm going, why should I? You know, is that going to make my property any more valuable with the possibility of a half a dozen level one and level two sets of them? And because of my past profession, they may not like me. So I can contend with one, but why should I sit there and have to contend with a half a dozen? So I think there is an obligation of the city to protect present property owners, values of the property, also the time that's going to be involved with dealing with the assessments, with the tax increments, and going, why even deal with it? I mean, everybody else is going with 1,000 feet, go with 1,000 feet, there's going to be a lawsuit, let it be a class action lawsuit, let's not be singled out, because we've got facilities and we've got the lowest standard, and this is where it's going to be.
So do we know how many communities have an ordinance like this? And
there's quite a few. I'm trying to, if I remember right, I've got samples from Chisago, Duluth.
Albertville,
right. I got at least four of them.
What was it in Albertville, 1,000?
I think it was. All the ones I've got were at least 1,000. Some of them were more. And I read some of this information that the Department of Corrections sends out about studies done by sociologists that find that the public safety benefit of an ordinance like this isn't that great. But I would question the samples that they're examining, because we had crime rates dropping in the 90s and even in the early parts of the 2000s around the country. And most of that was a result of greater sentences, more people incarcerated. And we still have a high incarceration rate. And right now we've got most of the sex offenders in Minnesota, after they're done with their criminal sentence, they've been civilly committed, and they're being held either at Moose Lake or St. Peter, and there's over 700 of them. And that's what when Ron refers to that, that's what he's talking about. We're looking at a federal judge who's threatening to, if Minnesota, if the legislature and doesn't respond, he'll take care of the problem, and he's talking about releasing them, and all of them, some of the remarks that have been published. So. And I don't know where they are on that. That's kind of died down. We haven't seen it, but they haven't resolved it, to my knowledge. And that could change the results and the public safety impact tremendously, I think, with a lot of these people. All of a sudden being released, we'll have a higher concentration. And obviously the ones that are in the community now, in my opinion, have been carefully, probably somewhat carefully screened, not perfectly, but that's why some of these studies, I think, released it, or come to the conclusion that these people don't pose as great a public safety risk as communities might think. And of course, I worked with a lot of these kinds of clients in my career doing public defender work in the courts. And Ron's out of law enforcement, so, I mean, his remarks are right on point. I mean, we haven't had any. None of these studies talk about the social or economic impact of, a lot of, if you get an influx of these people coming into your community. And I don't know where Brooklyn Center is, and I don't know if Robert Scott had any contact with them or not. But it was either Brooklyn Center or Brooklyn Park. I can't remember which one. That not too long ago was published in the Minneapolis paper that they had. Passed a total moratorium for, I believe it was 60 days. They weren't going to allow any of them to move back into their community. Now, whether you know, and I don't know that, that the Department of Corrections probably challenged that because it was 60 days, you know, so it's rather than fight with it, it's like by the time we get to the, get to a final decision, it'll be a moot point and the courts won't do anything with it.
Yeah, I, under land use, under statutory provisions for land use regulation, municipalities are given pretty broad discretion in using a 60-day moratorium to study a land use issue. So, but I agree with you, they couldn't even hardly bring the question, have it heard within 60 days. So,
but it's like, I mean, there's a lot of things here that, I mean, I do think there is a public safety concern and other issues that haven't been looked at. And Ron spoke to all of those, and I think appropriately. So, and I'm a little, like I say, I can see where 1,000 feet might blanket the whole community, but I, you know, I thought we had, like, my understanding was like 500, 1,000, and obviously they wouldn't do more than 1,000 if, you know, but we don't have 1,000. I would have liked to have seen that. I'm a little disappointed with that. But
well, I guess when I was doing the these, I could have had them do 1,000 as well as the 250-foot increments. Yeah. My concern as we ratcheted up that we were already walking pretty fine line as far as imposing an outright ban just by virtue of the size of the protected areas. And you're going to really develop some concentrations of offenders if you create very small pockets where they're eligible to live.
That was going to be my point. Is as I look at that 500 feet, I'm saying, what's our... You know, first of all, I'll tell you, I think it's a false sense of security because these folks, they just can't live by a park or a church or something. They can drive around. So the blanket idea isn't necessarily something that I'm opposed to, but I understand there's legal ramifications. But the way that that 500 map looks like, I'm having certain areas that there's just small pockets already available. And what about the landowners that live in those? Because anybody who's eligible to come here is going to go to those areas, and I'm going to advise them to put in a park.
What about in terms of liability now? I mean, now the fact that you know, I'm happy that up until this point that we haven't had any serious issues or anything like that in the community. It's good to be on this side of the problem. And if we're gonna err either way, at least for myself, I'm much more comfortable erring in terms of being too restrictive when it comes to an issue like this, because I think it's just when it has to do with kids and vulnerable adults and public safety, that's just, it's important. But now that it's even, you know, now that we're discussing it, I think it's almost incumbent on us to act in some form or fashion, because correct me if I'm wrong, I mean, because the discussion is being had, say we were to table it and say, well, whatever, should a situation occur in the meantime, are we now not somewhat liable for having looked at the issue and having done nothing?
No. I'm not an attorney, but my knowledge of municipal liability would say you hold no liability.
Well, the statute that permits some of this is for housing units of 6 or less persons.
Yep.
Okay.
And what it does do is, if I don't want to use the word preemption, but it does say that that kind of a facility is allowed in any area, you know.
Specifically 6 or less.
So, and what that means, the way I read it too, is what you're talking about is you can't, for example, they could buy a house in an R1 residential zone and open, if it's 6 or less people, they could open it up. On the other hand, we pass an ordinance that excludes, you know, a certain distance. They can't put it just anywhere. You know, right. We do have, and I think it's within the city's police powers. They can't. I don't think what the state's done preempts all action on this. And other cities have adopted ordinances similar to this. Some more restrictive, some less. And the district, Department of Corrections hasn't challenged one of them yet.
Not yet.
Yeah. So
I think the courts have
given far broader discretion to municipalities regulating sex offender housing than they give to the regulation of group homes, as we would typically picture a group home for learning impaired, developmentally disabled, any of those.
Right.
And if there was a person that was a sex offender, adjudicated as a sex offender, and wanted to move into a group home that was a licensed facility, they would not be allowed to do that if it falls in one of these protected zones. And I think that's the point Tim's making, is the city does have a little broader discretion in enforcing those locations.
And that's just under our general police powers, not under ours. We're not zoning, really, at this point. So,
what would the committee like to do?
I have a question, Mr. Chair. Do you have an estimate, Bruce, of what the approximate publication costs are for this ordinance?
No, but it's not that long an ordinance. It's not going to be that expensive.
I was just looking at it. It looks like a couple hundred bucks, probably. It looks like, it's not quite five pages if you count all the signature and informational stuff that goes on it once the city's
We could reduce the type to unreadable font size, and then we keep our costs down.
But, my question is, I know that that is a cost consideration when we publish it, and we don't want to publish an ordinance and then say, amend it. And even if you just change one word, I think we'd have to publish the whole business again.
If it changes anything that's substantial, if the desire of the committee is to see a larger scale map showing that 500 or the 1,000-foot buffer, my suggestion would be to table it, and I'll bring a 1,000-foot map back the next meeting.
That's what I would recommend, because I really want to see the parts that are residual that are sitting there. I think we could be creating a real issue for some areas of town.
Certain neighborhoods.
Right, which, again, I'd advocate for putting in a park or a church. But
if an apartment building fell in a gap or an area of higher concentration.
Yeah. Well, I'd like to see it, though. I too would like to see it. I don't like delaying, but I'd like to see it. Because if we were to proceed with 500 feet, and then we did discover that we had an option to go to 1,000, then we gotta
do it all again.
Yeah, redo it, and that would be a substantive change, to the effect of the ordinance. So we would have to, there'd be no shortcut, to amending the ordinance if we'd have to publish the thing.
Larry?
On Monday, if it's your intent and you're going to adopt an ordinance of some sort, staff could bring that to the council meeting and put it up on the overhead.
That would be my suggestion, because then we continue to, it's in play, it stays in play, rather than being put on the shelf for another month or another 2 weeks or whatever.
So if that's acceptable, we can certainly have that prepared by Monday evening. It won't take long at all. Would the action then be to have no action but to send it to the full council without a committee recommendation?
I guess I'd make a motion to send it to the full council accompanied with a map showing a 1,000 foot restriction.
Okay.
It's basically the restriction distance being the only factor left for debate.
So that which would enable the council to, the full council to give adequate, what I think would be full discussion and possible action on it. Otherwise, they don't have it, and I don't think.
That's fair.
So we're not recommending setting a public hearing yet, then. We just want to see the map.
Could at the council meeting. At the council meeting, if the ordinance will be there to be introduced, and if the decision is to change it to 1,000, then the next day before we publish, we just change it to 1,000.
Right. So. If that's an option, a viable option, right? That's the whole purpose. Yeah.
Again, I'll get the 1,000-foot, and I'll also get the 500-foot map on thumb drive as well, so we can put up the two right. contrasting right. at a little bigger scale.
It would be really nice if we can do that.
So what was your motion again?
That we send this on to the council accompanied by with the data we've currently have.
Plus the 1,000.
Send it on to the council for full consideration with the maps we currently have and add to it a 1,000-foot, a map showing a 1,000 diameter restriction.
Second. Okay. Further questions?
Mike, my concern would be if we go to a council meeting and all of a sudden I'm a citizen of the city of Wilmer and I just found out you went to 1,000 feet and I found out that my neighborhood is the only neighborhood now in the city of Wilmer where all sex offenders can live, and I had no chance to voice my concerns over that. You just passed it at one fell swoop.
No, this would just be introducing the ordinance. There would still have to be a public hearing.
Good, because still go to public hearing.
That didn't sit well. All right. Okay. Yep. I'm cool with that.
Yeah, the public will always have the opportunity to weigh in. Yeah.
That way, if people are affected in that manner, they can certainly show up.
All right.
And I would, obviously, if I knew of any, I would encourage them. I would contact them and... You know.
Larry?
Mr. Chair, maybe Bruce knows this, but I think with it's like a supermajority vote, we can publish a summary of the ordinance. I mean, if that's any concern at all.
Yeah, you can
that's right.
On a lengthy ordinance, you can publish a summary and then just make sure that in the summary that's published, it states that copies are available online or in the office of the city clerk, I believe, the way the statute reads. In fact, I don't even think the statute has it online yet, but... From a practical standpoint, we would.
Any other questions? We've got a motion on the table. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? That carries. Let's see what happens Monday.
Let me, I paraphrase here just to make sure I get something accurate in the minutes. So the motion was to send the matter to the full council for discussion with maps of the 500-foot and 1,000-foot protected areas.
There, then?
Yeah. That one's solved.
Next item is the Y project update.
Just provide a quick update on our Railroad Y project. We've had a lot of ongoing discussion. We've been having a lot of meetings and teleconferences with our partners. The decision was made at a meeting 2 weeks ago to select the value engineering alternative, which is the one that would reroute Highway 12 to the south. Variety of reasons were noted in that decision, and if you'd like, I can provide the 28 pages of minutes that came out of that meeting we had, but...
That's okay.
Yeah, the end result was that the value engineering route was selected. Still some discussions going on about responsibilities for certain trackage and spur access because BNSF has wanted to scale back their portion of the project and not do a full double track. They want to just do a single track with the option of installing a second track sometime in the future. So... within the next few weeks, the real negotiations will begin, and it's going to be a situation where the city, the county, and MnDOT are unified in our approach, and we will be sitting down with BNSF, and the approach we're taking is that this is not the time to change the scope of the project. We sold this project for the Tiger Grant based on these premises, and if you want to change that now, the Federal Railway Administration may very well look at the project and say, well, we don't think that meets our qualifications for a Tiger Grant anymore. So unless Burlington Northern wants to scale back and pony up another $10 million to offset the Tiger Grant, I think they've got a pretty weak position to
negotiate, unless they just say, well, we're going to walk away from the project in its entirety. And, you know, any of the partners has that option at any point. But we'll be getting into the environmental pretty soon. The Federal Railway Administration will be out here in early April to look at the site. We're pressing them to make a decision regarding the level of environmental review that would be required. And we're hoping that they will allow us to file, which is the simplest method, which is just called a categorical exclusion. You have to document environmental issues, but you're able to conclude right from the beginning that there are no environmental impacts, and then you just have some narrative that shows why. The other option is to do a full-blown environmental assessment at the federal level. That's much more involved and will take more time. Either one is doable, but we've got until September of 2017 to have a fully executed grant agreement with the FRA, and we can't get an executed grant agreement until the environmental review process is complete. So we see the categorical exclusion as a possible way to accelerate the project. So,
okay. Any questions? Any info on any updates in town?
Well, I'll give you one. We've had some increased interest lately in nuisance and zoning violations.
I read something in the paper.
Yeah. Just had staff do some summaries, and very simply, in 2015, staff conducted, cited, and inspected 630 property inspections for nuisance and zoning violations. Through March 17th, staff has done 130 properties, so we're on pace to get very close to that 600 number again this year. We like to think there's light at the end of the tunnel, but that's not always the case.
These are complaints.
No, these are not necessarily complaints. These are anything that it was either a complaint or something that staff saw and cited when they were out in the field. Okay. So, those numbers do not reflect the hazardous, the emergency, or the extreme violations that are handled by a courtesy call or direct contact. These are the ones where we went on site and actually created a paper trail. We deal with a lot of issues where we just pick up the phone and say, hey, we see this, take care of it. Or this is if it's an imminent safety issue, we let them know, and we give them 24 hours to correct it. We don't even do paper in that regard. We just go back on site the next day and say, okay, it's taken care of. And we have very, very good response with those issues. So that's kind of where we're at with our zoning and nuisance violations. Staff has been very aggressive, spending a lot more time in the field. We'll continue to do so as we've got a continued lull in some of the construction due to the weather. We've got more time to put them out in the field and get those things done.
What was the number through the 17th of March?
130 properties.
So anything on that new business that wanted to come by Runnings?
Yes.
Name them yet?
No, I can't. But I can tell you that we have completed our discussions with the developer. It's my understanding that the developer has reached their final agreement with the tenant of the building, and we should be seeing a plat application very quickly. That property and the Runnings property are going to be doing some swapping of property that requires platting to clean that all up. So we'll see that coming very soon. Should see that application by the end of the month. If that is filed, depending upon how they word it, it could trigger the public announcement or the public disclosure of the name. But, or next time I talk to them, I'll just say, is this still a secret? And I'll get their permission. So. So we got that one, the Cornelius property north of Slumberland. They should be tearing those buildings down pretty quickly. We've issued demolition permits for that site.
What's going on there?
An 8,000 square foot retail facility. About 5,000 of it's already leased out, and they've got about 2,800. I think they're advertising for lease still on the sign out front. You've seen they're taking down Trav's Dynomart finally.
It's fenced in.
Yep. So we'll see what Marcus is doing on that site. Still haven't heard if they've got anything in the works or if it's all speculative. Okay. continue to work with Dooley's on the industrial park development and continue to work with a couple other prospective tenants in the industrial park.
So our new community or county guy?
Yes.
Community or whatever he is, economic. He was talking about shovel ready.
Yeah.
Aren't our property shovel ready out there as soon as the road gets in?
In my opinion, they are. The state of Minnesota has a program where you have to provide all sorts of information to an independent third party, and then this independent third party has a checklist, and they decide if you're shovel ready. It involves a fair amount of money to do that. It requires a survey that I think is not needed for out there that probably would cost $10,000 to $12,000. There's a $3,200 application fee to have the third party come out to Wilmer and look at the site and make the determination if it is shovel ready. I'm not a big fan. I'm not aware of any city that's ever gotten a business to locate there because the state called them shovel ready. Deed does say that they will give priority to shovel ready sites that are part of that program when they get contacts from business and industry. From a political standpoint and a practical standpoint, I don't know that that's in their best interest to do that. I think they need to have an equal sharing, an equal distribution. Leave it up to the company to decide if the information they're getting is adequate and not have an independent third party do it. Larry and I have had this conversation. Aaron had the Windham Industrial Park deemed shovel ready. He seems to place a lot of importance on it. To me, what's more important is having local economic development people know what's there and being able to transmit that information to interested businesses without delay and to get them a total packet of information when it's requested. And there's no reason you can't put that together without having an independent third party tell you that you did a good job. So I think Aaron wanted to come to this committee at some point in the future and talk about that and suggest it. If the council wants to do that, that's fine. Just be aware there are costs. And it was discussed at the EDC Operations Board meeting last week, and it was pretty well received. But the board members did say, well, if it's the city's industrial park, the city should be picking up the tab for the costs. And we've not budgeted for any of those costs. And it's not to say it couldn't be done, that the money couldn't be found, and it's not like we're talking thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars, but it does come at a cost, and that $12,000-$15,000, whatever, may be better utilized in an expanded marketing campaign. I don't know. Yeah. Leave that up to the committee and the council to decide when that question is put in front of you.
How about the house on Olaf and Campbell? Anything there?
Those were referred back to the city attorney some time ago, and we have not seen any action. I'll be honest with you, I've kind of forgotten about them for a couple of weeks, so I'll follow up with Robert on those tomorrow.
Okay. Anything else, Tim?
Yeah, I have a question. You're talking about, the Dynamart, they're going to take that down. What about the house immediately west of that, behind it?
Let me say for the record, that'd be a wonderful idea to demolish that house. It's vacant now. It's owned by Carol Gilbertson, managed by her son Tom. You knew Steve that had the fuel oil and the gas station. So
they never sold that to Marcus.
No, they didn't. I'm not sure it's in violation of any ordinances right now because the site is picked up. It's just that the structure is not in the best of condition. It's not occupied and under the rental program, so there's no ability to site there. But the only thing we'd be able to do would be to look at it and see if we can issue some citations under exterior conditions ordinance. And I will ask Randy to go down there and look at that, and it might be such that we just contact the Gilbertsons and initiate a conversation, see what they want to do.
Anything anything else? Larry?
Bruce, maybe do you want to touch on, we talked about at the next staff meeting, to talk about some of the trailers that are parked on, maybe just share that and maybe make them aware that the public's been...
Yeah, we've initiated some discussion internally about trailers being parked in the street for extended periods of time, and the city's got different time periods that they allow trailers under the ordinance if they're attached to a vehicle or left alone. If they're not attached, I don't believe they're allowed at all in the streets. I'd have to double check, except for contractor trailers and those types of jobs where there's an active job going on at the site, and even those are very tightly regulated. So I think we're going to be taking a look at that issue. We're starting to find a lot more boats and campers and stuff that are left in the streets for extended periods of time. And I know it's one of those things that absolutely can't float to the top of the police department's concern list, but we are starting to get more neighborhood complaints about them. So I think we need to at least kick the idea around and see if there's something different needed in either how the ordinance is drafted or in how we might be able to enforce. Typically, if it's in the street or within the right-of-way, my department only gets involved if it's garbage accumulations in the boulevards or something. If it's a vehicle and it's in the right-of-way, that traditionally has been a municipal code issue, with the responsibility falling back to the PD. There are times we will talk to the PD and they will go out and they will mark it and we'll have enforcement that way. We'll follow through on it and the PD will follow through on it. But it's been something that we just haven't put a lot of effort into in the past. But may need to.
I know I've had a couple of neighbors that were nailed last year for having boats, pontoon parked in the street. Then they blame me. I didn't do it. I didn't call in and complain.
Well, yeah, when they come into our office, we show them the Rick Fagerly hotline button right on our phone. So.
But yeah, I mean, if the police are just patrolling neighborhoods, if they see a boat, can't they just stop, chalk it?
We can. I know the community service officers that handle a lot of our parking issues, they did put a higher priority on that this last year and marked a lot more, cited a lot more. I think that hotline button must have been rerouted to me part of the time, too.
Perfect.
So, I know when it comes to trailers on the street, to really simplify it for most trailers, it's a four-hour time limit on the street, your campers, your fish houses, utility trailers, that type of thing. If they're not hooked up to a vehicle, then they have 48 hours that falls under the vehicle parking when it's there. So.
I think it's important to note that our city public works director was cited for a trailer violation last year. So. Got home late
on
one night.
15th or what, where he lives now?
Out there.
Oh, okay.
Got home late one night with their, I think it was the boat, and he just unhooked it in the street and didn't want to back it in that night. Came out the next morning, 4 hours are up. He got a ticket. So there are times it is enforced, and it's difficult. It's such a transient issue. If they're coming and going, nobody cares. It's the ones that get left for the extended periods of time.
Yeah. Anything else? Motion to adjourn then.
So moved.
All right, we're adjourned. Thanks. How about some of these tractors now that they come and they drive them in there. Drive
you know.
You know, there again, we don't have any ordinance that says you can't park your work vehicle in your driveway.